Welcome to Downrange Radio and our ongoing exclusive coverage of DC v. Heller, the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court on the meaning of the Second Amendment. I'm your host, Michael Bain, also the host of Shooting Gallery on the Outdoor Channel every Wednesday night. And, of course, Downrange Radio is the audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television, www.downrange.tv. Brought to you by our friends at Midway USA, Para USA, and Ruger Firearms. Now, leading up to the oral arguments on Heller on Tuesday, March 18th, one of the questions we got a lot here at Downrange Radio, Downrange Television, was tell us a little bit about the amicus briefs. That is, there were a record number of amicus briefs, which means friends of the court briefs filed for the oral arguments. And from everybody, from both sides of the field, a tremendous number of briefs were filed. And the question we got is, what do those briefs mean? How are they used? How do the justices use those briefs? Well, one of the briefs was filed by the National Shooting Sports Foundation and their lead counsel, Larry Keene. And that brief from NSSF had apparently a profound effect, at least on one of the justices, on Justice Kennedy. So we wanted to go to Larry Keene, who has been NSSF lead counsel for quite a number of years. In fact, Larry Keene was the attorney who led the charge against all the state lawsuits. He also led the charge for the national preemption bill to protect the industry from all those lawsuits filed by the states trying to bankrupt the firearms industry. So Larry has been instrumental, and of course the whole National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is our industry trade group, but Larry has been instrumental in arguing some of the most critical legal cases that we've had here in dealing with the right to keep and bear arms. So I went to Larry and said, let's talk a little bit about the NSSF brief and the effect that it seemed to have in the oral argument.
One thing a couple of analysts told me, including Dave Koppel, he said that in listening to some of the questions, especially from Justice Kennedy, he heard echoes of the NSSF brief.
He did. We were thrilled and pleased and frankly honored that Justice Kennedy seemed to clearly echo themes from our amicus brief, the National Shooting Sports Foundation's brief that we filed, in asking questions of the lawyer representing the district, Walter Dellinger, a former Solicitor General under the Clinton administration, where he asked him about whether the Second Amendment provided a right for, you know, settlers on the frontier to have firearms to protect themselves against, you know, bears and wolves and hostile Indians. And that comes, you know, literally right out of, it seems anyway, right out of our brief. And to my understanding, and no other amicus brief of the 80 or so filed on both sides collectively really touched on this issue. So, you know, I was right there in the second row, I had to contain myself from sort of, you know, shouting, you know, whoopee or something, because it was just so gratifying personally as a lawyer and also to hear Justice Kennedy speaking of the Second Amendment as providing an individual right, because Justice Kennedy is the critical swing vote in so many decisions by the Supreme Court. You know, there are 9 justices. You need 5 justices to vote, to have a majority. And so, you know, the court is, sort of has its ideological camps. And he is, considered the critical swing vote. Before him, Sandra Day O'Connor was considered the critical swing vote. So for him to speak in those terms of an individual right, not in any way connected to a militia or, you know, an organized militia, was extremely important for the case, and I think clearly tips the balance in favor of finding that it's an individual right. My guess, and it's purely a guess, and it's always dangerous to guess what the Supreme Court's going to do based on, or any court, frankly, on oral argument. But it seemed from the questioning and the repeated questions and comments by the judges, and, you know, typically or very often the questions the justices ask are sometimes designed to, you know, draw out an argument or test a theory, and sometimes they're intended to communicate information to their fellow justices. They will use questions to argue with each other, if you will, on the bench, and that happened quite a bit, actually, on Tuesday, where, you know, one justice would ask a question, and before the lawyer arguing at the time could answer, even yes or no, another justice piled on with another question. So that's sort of how, you know they're arguing with each other on the bench. But Justice Kennedy, it seemed pretty clear, did rely upon or certainly had read our brief when he talked about the right of, colonists or settlers to have firearms to protect themselves against wolves and Indians and such. And, you know, you can read the transcript of the oral argument on our website. We have a link to it. And the question actually comes very early in the argument. So it was, right out of the blocks. But, you know, our brief reads, firearms were commonly viewed as essential to protecting colonists from attacks by Native Americans, insurrections from slaves, and harm from wild animals. Firearms also provided superior to other weapons in hunting for both food and trade. The vast number of wild game and fowl that inhabited the North America, so much so that Native Americans, when possible, abandoned their traditional weaponry for new firearms. And so when Justice Kennedy started asking those questions, it was pretty clear that he had read, seemed to us anyway, to be pretty clear that he read our brief. And I didn't get a chance to talk with David after the argument, but I'm glad to hear he thought so as well.
Yeah, he was, as you know, sprinting to Taiwan. just on a personal note, you've been, you personally have been such a stalwart in the fight for Second Amendment rights for so many years. Just being able to sit in the Supreme Court chamber, it must have been a tremendous vindication to so much of what you've dedicated your life to.
It was immensely, it was just a tremendous experience to have the opportunity as a lawyer admitted to the Supreme Court bar to sit in the Supreme Court and watch history in the making. I mean, this is, one of those rare cases that will have tremendous impact on America. And particularly when you're, this is not some tax case or, something like that. This is, a fundamental civil liberty. This, the right of self-defense is a fundamental human right. And it was, it was really important and gratifying to hear Justices Roberts and Scalia and Kennedy talking about the Second Amendment in terms of the right of self-defense. And, there was quite a bit of discussion about, dusty old English books, people from the 16th century and writing in Blackstone and about, principal rights and fundamental rights of self-preservation, self-protection, and that firearms, the right to arms, going back to English common law, was a right, what was described by Blackstone as an auxiliary right that protects the fundamental right of the principal right of self-defense, self-preservation. And even if you go back and look at, for example, the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and among them are these rights is, the right to life, and so that clearly includes the right, obviously, to defend your life. So it was, really terrific, I feel very comfortable in predicting that the Supreme Court will find an individual right after that. it's just hard to predict, and I hope that what does not come of this is a decision by the court that it's an individual right, but that it becomes a hollow right, an illusory right, because the standard of review is such that all manner of restrictions pass constitutional muster, and it really renders the right hollow, and it's a Pyrrhic victory. So, and that's the concern I have, and that's the problem, frankly, with the brief filed by the Solicitor General for the United
yes,
States.
Yes.
They're very good on the individual right issue, but I don't understand why the Solicitor General would believe that this personal individual right in the Bill of Rights is somehow worthy of less constitutional protection than other fundamental liberties and civil rights, like the right to freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of worship. So it's hopefully that won't come. I mean, it's hard to tell. It was, I think, difficult for me anyway to predict where the court might come out on that issue. It is possible that they don't reach consensus on that point. There won't be five votes potentially for finding that the level of review is strict scrutiny, and in which case the lower courts have no guidance from the court. There will be no the decision won't have, with respect to that issue, won't have precedential value. And then the lower appellate courts and state courts will be free to determine for themselves or to start developing law on what the standard should be. And that gives me great concern because I would anticipate that courts that have, have heretofore been unfriendly towards the Second Amendment and gun rights will accept the lower standard and allow for all manner of restrictions to stand, possibly even bans on handguns. I mean, there was discussion by, for example, Justice Breyer asking a lawyer arguing for Heller, Alan Gura, whether or not the ban on handguns in urban areas with high crime, where the crimes are committed with handguns, is a reasonable restriction given given the public safety issue. And that's very troubling to me, and it was at times hard to sort of contain yourself. You want to just jump up and shout out the answer. The answer is the Second Amendment doesn't provide a right for criminals to use firearms to commit crimes. In fact, the Second Amendment allows individuals to have the right to have a firearm to protect themselves and defend themselves from those criminals. So no, a ban on handguns does not pass constitutional muster. It is clearly unreasonable, and it infringes upon the individual right of self-defense. So we'll have to wait and see. We will know by late June what the court's decision is.
Now, in addition to the fact that you were fairly busy in Washington, NSSF, yourself, and the National Shooting Sports Foundation was involved in and still is involved in a major battle in Connecticut, correct? You're home.
John, we have some legislation pending in Connecticut. It's pending elsewhere in the United States as well. But there was a legislative hearing on Monday on two pieces of legislation. One of the bills would require ammunition manufacturers to place a unique serial number on each bullet and on each cartridge casing. And they would have to, of course, correspond in each bullet, each assembled cartridge. Then they'd have to put those serial numbers on a box, and then when consumers purchased, law-abiding citizens purchased ammunition in Connecticut, they would then be recorded who purchased what ammunition, and then that would go to some government database. We've faced similar legislation in California a number of years ago, and fortunately it was defeated, but the patent holder of this technology has a lobbying firm working for them that is it pushing this in other states, and it's now in Connecticut. The other, and then the manufacturers, the ammunition manufacturers, have made clear that it's in essence a de facto ban on ammunition, because as a practical matter, it is simply impossible to put a unique serial number on each of the approximately 10 billion, billion cartridges that are manufactured domestically each year. And also, you would be required of ammunition that was coming in from imported into the United States, and that's several billion more rounds of ammunition every year. We were fighting that. And then there's another bill that would require manufacturers, at least of pistols initially, to place the micro laser engrave on the tip of the firing pin the make, model, and serial number of the gun, and then it would also require that information to be someplace else on the firearm that comes in contact with the cartridge casing, and the theory being it would imprint that information onto the primer and somewhere else on the cartridge casing, so that when in theory the police would be able just to pick up the shell casing with a little simple magnifying glass, read the serial number, and then conduct a trace of that firearm. The problem is that independent peer-reviewed study of this patented sole source technology establishes that a number of things. Number one is it doesn't work reliably. It doesn't work as the patent holder advertises. And more than half the time, you know, the information is not accurately and clearly and legibly imprinted onto the cartridge casing. The type of ammunition that you use will change the results. How the gun is maintained by the consumer will change the result, etc. Secondly, the markings on the firing pin, because they are very, very shallow, they're only 25 microns, that is half the diameter of the human hair. You can simply take an emery board, a file, a sand, you know, a sharpening stone, and, you know, one, two swipes, and it's gone. The markings are obliterated. You know, criminals obliterate the serial numbers on the firearms now. There's no reason to think they wouldn't do that if you put the serial number elsewhere, certainly when it's readily accessible and can be done easily. And the third issue or problem is that, you know, the parts that are marked can simply be swapped out for unmarked parts by criminals, and they can avoid the issue entirely, and, you know, criminals acquire firearms from a variety of sources. They steal them, and so if they steal guns that are already out there, they're not going to be marked, or they get them from out of state, and so those aren't going to be, you know, micro laser engraved as well. So, you know, and some manufacturers have told me that the cost to implement this patented, unreliable, patented sole source technology could raise the price of guns by as much as $200 a gun.
Wow.
So they will stop, very likely to stop selling guns into that marketplace. And, you know, unfortunately, in California, I mean, where else? In California, this legislation passed last year over very strenuous objections from industry. And after a study by the University of California at Davis that established that this technology does not work reliably, is easily defeated, and should be studied further, and that report, specifically said that it does not recommend adopting legislation to mandate this technology. And there have been now three studies of this technology, all of which have reached the same conclusion, that it's unreliable, easily defeated, and should be studied further. The most recent report is by the National Academy of Sciences just 2 weeks ago, when they put out a report after several years of study on the issue of whether it's feasible to have a national ballistics imaging database. And they concluded it's not, for the same reasons that an earlier study by the California Department of Justice reached that same conclusion, for a number of reasons. But they also looked at the issue of microstamping, both bullet serialization and firearms microstamping. And they concluded that and recommended further in-depth study of those technologies as well, because there are issues about reliability, there are issues of cost to manufacture, and there are issues about the ease with which it can be defeated and evaded by criminals. On Monday, the firearms manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers got together, particularly the companies based in Connecticut, and we held a press conference at the Capitol in Hartford to announce unified industry-wide opposition to both of these bills for, you know, all of the reasons I've just outlined. Mm-hmm. It was a very well-attended press conference. We had very, very good coverage by the media, and we were able, to communicate that information to the public. And then we, had members of industry testify at the legislative hearing. I'll tell you, for example, that representatives from Colt Manufacturing, which is based in East Hartford,
right,
told the committee and stated at the press conference that if firearms microstamping passes and is enacted into law in Connecticut, because any guns they make will have to have this, they will seriously consider and probably will leave the state of Connecticut. and other manufacturers have said likewise that they would stop, they would not manufacture guns with firearms microstamping, and that they too would have to consider leaving the state. We know that other state economic development offices from, you know, places like South Dakota and Idaho and Oklahoma and Georgia and Alabama and elsewhere. I mean, I get calls not infrequently from these economic development agencies from various states, looking to, who do I need to talk to at these companies about leaving Connecticut or leaving Massachusetts and coming to our state where, we're not hostile to firearms and we'll welcome those jobs. Not unlike what's going on even, for example, in Illinois, where manufacturers left Illinois and moved across the river into Iowa, where they're not constantly under attack by the legislature. And, Connecticut is the home of the firearms industry. It is where Eli Whitney invented interchangeable parts for firearms. And where, Winchester just closed down their factory in New Haven, where Eli Whitney is from, and Mossberg and Marlin are just up in North Haven, right next door. You have Colt and you have other manufacturers. Smith & Wesson testified. He came down for the hearing as well from Springfield. It's a serious problem, and the technology does not work. As we made clear, we're not opposed to this technology because it's quote unquote gun control. We're opposed to it because independent peer reviewed studies indicate very clearly it doesn't work reliably, it's easily defeated, and it's easily avoided. And we don't think it's a good public policy decision to mandate that technology, considering the results of the independent studies, and that the legislature ought not rely upon the word of the patent holder, and they don't have to take our word for it. I'm not asking them to take our word for it. I think they should listen to the scientists at the National Academy rather than the patent holder who's looking to, put money in his pocket.
Well, I just want to congratulate you. I know you're looking to get out for a long weekend and finally take your first break since SHOT Show, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk, and I wanted just to congratulate you and thank you for everything that both you personally and the National Shooting Sports Foundation has done for gun rights, because you guys have been absolute rocks over the last couple of decades, and I want my own listeners, I would like for them to understand that we would have never gotten to Washington. We would have never gotten to oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court without you guys working constantly. So, Larry, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Those are very kind words, Michael. There are a lot of, we're happy to be involved, and we're happy to participate. There are a lot of important people doing a lot of heavy lifting on the issue, We're glad to be part of it. I'm, personally consider it a privilege to be involved in the issue to protect a civil liberty and to protect, frankly, the ability of people to defend their lives.
Well, thank you very much. Let me let you go ahead, take your extra time off, take a nap. It's a good time to take a nap because it's going to start up again soon.
Monday morning, bright and early.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Michael.
Here at Downrange Radio, we hope that our expanded coverage of the oral arguments for DC v. Heller, the meaning of the Second Amendment in the Supreme Court, have given you a little greater depth and hopefully a little greater understanding of what it took for us to get to these oral arguments. Because there's a sense, I think, that, wow, it's about time the Supreme Court took this up. This could have happened any time, but boy, it's about time. No. The fact that we are before the Supreme Court to discuss the individual rights interpretation of the Second Amendment is the result of a lot of work. A lot of work by people like Larry Keene in the National Shooting Sports Association. All the attorneys and lobbyists of the National Rifle Association. Independent legal analysts like David Hardy. Academicians and lawyers like Joseph Olson. All these men, John Lott, of course, all of them have had a tremendous effect in getting us to where we are now. And as you heard from Larry Keene, even if we get an individual interpretation of the Second Amendment, it doesn't necessarily get us where we need to be. I think one of the points that I'm certain that you've gotten from this expanded coverage is that no matter what happens, the fight goes on. Right now, as we speak, Brady is sending out funding letters to try to get more money to fight us, to strike at our rights. So we have to remain vigilant. We have to be prepared to do battle. I believe it was Robert Heinlein, the great science fiction writer, who said that one of the prices of freedom is a willingness to do battle full out anytime, any place. And that is how we approach protecting our right to keep and bear arms. I am your host, Michael Bain. Thank you so much for joining us on our expanded coverage of DC v. Heller. You can be sure that any other critical issue facing the gun culture, you'll hear about it first on Downrange Television, on Downrange Radio, and you will see the best and most expanded coverage of it right here on DRTV. Again, thank you very much. Stay safe out there, boys and girls.